You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
We have assembled today a formidable panel of experts to discuss major shifts in the landscape of global trade negotiations and how they are likely to impact on Latin America. Whatever the reason, be it that the World Trade Organization is a very complex forum to make progress in highly sensitive areas such as intellectual property, services, harmonization of safety, health, and technical standards, government procurement, etc., be it that emerging powers such as China and Russia are more committed to state capitalism, and there's a need to preserve an open, rules-based international order. Whatever the case might be, two mega regional trade agreements are emerging: the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership between the U.S. and Europe, and the Trans-Pacific Partnership between the U.S., Japan, and other Asian and Latin American countries. These two agreements cover a huge share of global trade, and therefore, this so-called high-standard 21st-century RTAs have the potential of changing the landscape of global trade negotiations as we know them. These mega RTAs are likely to include only countries at similar stages of development or developing countries that are willing to accept developed country standards in exchange for market access. Many emerging countries could thus be marginalized from the process. How should Latin America reposition itself strategically in light of these changes? Are the apparently irreconcilable orientations of the Pacific Alliance and Mercosur, the two major trading blocs in the region, an insurmountable obstacle for a common regional strategy? How all these mega shifts in global trade negotiations will play out for Latin America? How are the governments of the region likely to react to these changes? Is this an opportunity that the region should grasp? Hopefully, the panel will help us answer some of these questions, and we are looking forward for a highly engaging discussion. There's much to be learned. I will now pass the floor to Harold Trincunas, my esteemed colleague, senior fellow and director of the Foreign Policy Latin American Initiative, who will moderate the discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Ernesto, for your introductory remarks. My role in this event is more to be one of moderator and perhaps provoke some discussion. The rules of order is that we'll start out with approximately 10 minutes of discussion from each of our panelists, followed by about 20 minutes or so of discussion among you, and then we'll turn to the floor for questions from the audience. So without much further ado, allow me to introduce our panel members. Antoni Esteva de Ordal from the Inter-American Development Bank, who will lead off the discussion, followed by Joshua Meltzer, fellow at the Brookings Institution, and Jeff Schott, senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Antoni, if you'd like to lead us off, about 10 minutes.
Thank you very much, Harold. Thank you very much, Ernesto, for the invitation. Let me just use these 10 minutes to maybe talk a little bit about, to put a little bit the context on in which Latin America, the Latin America that we have today in the context that Ernesto was mentioning. And I will start just kind of mentioning that the title of the meeting, Global Trade Negotiations at Crossroads, How Latin America Fits In, is a great title for 2014. It probably had been a very good title also 20 years ago. And I'll talk a little bit about what happened 20 years ago to put a little bit in the context of where we are today, because I think it's very important to understand where we come from in terms of the way that Latin America is integrating into the global economy. 20 years ago, in 1994, actually is the same, kind of 20 years exactly, we had a very interesting convergence of potential deals for Latin America at the time. We have first a very active multilateral system, relatively active at the time. We just finished the Uruguay round. We launched the WTO in 1995. This was the last agreement until the one that we got last year in Bali. So there was a relatively active multilateral system in which Latin America was playing a big role. And we had three initiatives at the same time that competing with each other in a way. One was the FTAA, which was launched also in 1994, mostly driven by the United States. This is a very interesting initiative one think about today. There were the 34-plus countries in the Americas with the United States and Canada sitting together negotiating a trade deal. This was just 20 years ago, every single country on the table. At the same time, we had Mercosur that was trying to put together, at the time, the customs union, so in a way to consolidate the old way of doing integration in the region based on customs unions following the European model. Let's remember that there are very few customs unions around the world, only basically in Latin America besides the European Union and in some cases in Africa. So it was a very specific way of actually integrating into the global economy, and Mercosur was leading the way at the time. And then we had NAFTA also in 1994, which was a completely new way of making these type of trade deals. This is the first agreement between a North and South country in our region with the United States and Canada. So we had the full menu of possible ways of engaging with the global economy and with the regional partners. We know very well what happened afterwards. The only real initiative that really took over and became the model for the rest of the region was the NAFTA model. It was the bilateral agreement, and as you know, the story from 1995 up to now has been this proliferation of FTAs, bilateral agreements in the region, not only in the region, but also outside the region. The FTA got stuck, the Mercosur, we know what's happening with these customs unions in our region, and of course the WTO also got in a frozen mode. So it's very interesting to look back at what the region, the menu that the region had at the time. The balance of what has happened is quite positive. I mean, if you look at what the region has been able to achieve in these 20 years of what we call now preferential liberalization through FTAs, it's quite impressive. I mean, the tariffs have come down very fast. This is one of the regions that has dismantled tariffs at the fastest pace on a preferential basis. There's some evidence also that this preferential liberalization what has also led to unilateral liberalization. As you know, the WTO just deals with bound tariffs. The MFN tariffs, the ones that you are actually applying to your neighbors, has also been coming down very rapidly in a parallel way to the preferential tariffs. So there has been a lot of preferential liberalization. We have removed most of the traditional cost in terms of doing trade when we talk about tariffs. What happened from 94 to now, which I think is very important to remember how the context has changed and see how the region today is facing a completely different challenge. And I want just to mention five big structural changes that were not on the table 20 years ago for the region. The first one is Asia. We know very well that Asia was not in the picture 20 years ago. This is something completely, it's a new market for the region. 10, 15 years ago, this is when we start trading and competing with this region, especially China. If you look at the figures before 2000, Asian trade, the Asian share of Latin American trade is less than 10%, it's more than 20%. So this changes completely the importance of a partner that was not in the picture of Latin America. Second big change in the way that the global economy works is what now we call this emergence of global value chain or the fragmentation of production. This is a completely new way of doing business in which the production is split across borders. The numbers are a little bit more difficult to pin down here, but we have done some recent research, and there's two ways of measuring the level of fragmentation and how a country participate in this kind of global value chain. One way of looking at that is how much of your exports incorporate foreign value added from other countries. So how much of what you sell comes actually from things that you import. The number for Latin America today is around 20%. for Asia is 40%. We're far from the levels of integrations that Asian countries have. Another way of measuring this is how much of what you export becomes foreign value added of other people's exports. The numbers here are more similar between Latin America and Asia. It's around 30%, but of course very different. We export mineral or natural resources that become inputs for other people's exports. In the case of Asia, it's mostly intermediate goods. So still we are far from the way that Asian participates in this global value chain, but it's a completely different way of doing business and, of course, has implications for the way we conduct trade policy. It's very different to do trade policy today in this fragmented way of producing things than 20 years ago. Third, and this is related to what I just said before, is this complex architecture. We have this huge mess of trade agreements around the world. We have more than 300 active preferential agreements that have been negotiated. The calculation is that around 40, depending on how you do the numbers, between 40 and 60% of global trade is conducted under preferential, on a preferential basis. So this is a completely new way of what we had a few years back. And a couple of more things that are also important for context. One is, and this I think explains what I just said before in terms of at least in this region, the way that we have dismantled traditional costs, basically tariffs. The real costs for business today are related to infrastructure, related to logistics, the way that you actually can move physically goods from one border to another. This is the real bottleneck in terms of trade costs for the regions, and of course this calls for a completely different way of thinking about integration. And the last point, very briefly, maybe we can talk about this later in the discussion, the private sector. The most of the way that, not all countries, but some countries in the regions, the logic of integration in many, many cases has the logic of the private sector. It's more bottom-up than a top-down approach. And where we are today, after these 20 years, 2014, I just mentioned these kind of big structural changes, the region faces a context in which, in a way, you go back to the mid-90s, you have again, maybe, and Jeff probably will have lots of things to say here, a renewal of the WTO, of the multilateral system. At least we have seen some action last year in Bali. So the multilateral system seems that it's ready to work again. And you have a completely new scheme that Ernesto was mentioning on regionalism. And here I think the challenges is a challenge of what some people have called it kind of how to recalibrate the system that we have today. You have this, on the one side you have the WTO, the multilateral system working maybe again, and you have these new agreements appearing in the negotiations. And I think there are two things that are down the road. One is a task of aggregation. If you have so many agreements that involve so many countries, one of the challenges is how you aggregate some of those agreements into larger pieces of negotiations. This is what we call sometimes convergence. We have to pick up several agreements and put them together. Most of the TPP is among countries that have already agreements among themselves. The Pacific Alliance, which is a very good example of what's happening in terms of convergence in our regions, is exactly that. This is countries that have very modern agreements among themselves, and they are just trying to harmonize, to get converged into some sort of... So there's this issue about aggregation of what we have, and this is the role of, for example, the mega-regionals. And then the other thing that is missing is what we could call connecting the missing links. There are some big missing links that have not been connected through what has happened in the last 20 years. And there are two big missing links. One is among big northern countries, and you see the US and the European Union trying to get an agreement, but also you see Japan in the game, Canada, and so on. So there's a big north-north missing link that has not been yet connected. But also there's some missing links among big south-south countries. You know, the big in the south have not yet been connected by this. So it's a problem of, or a task, if you want, ahead of us in terms of aggregation, that what has already been achieved, but also of connecting links that have not yet been connected. I can talk a little bit maybe on the discussion about how specific initiatives are dealing with this. I know more closely what's happening in the Pacific Alliance. I'm sure that my colleagues will can talk a little bit more in detail on the TPP or the TTIP. But maybe just to finish in the last minute, Harold, what are the kind of the scenarios that, I mean, of course, we don't have answers. From the point of view of Latin America, what are the potential scenarios? In a context in which the WTO seems to become more active, and in the context in which the agreements have to be, in a way, recalibrated of what has happened in the last 20 years, many things could happen. One, and Jeff has discussed this at length in several papers, is maybe we could witness what we witnessed in the mid-90s, where a big regional agreement imposed some pressure on the WTO. This is what NAFTA did for the Uruguay round. Some people have thought that maybe the TPP, TTIP will also do the same thing for the new multilateral rounds in Geneva. So there's this potential impact on the regionalism to the WTO. And in the context of the region, I think this is a much, much more complicated scenario. Here you have a Pacific Alliance that is bringing together countries that have almost never been part of traditional blocs. Mexico has never been part of a traditional block of integration in the region, of course, separated from NAFTA. And Chile. Chile was part of the Andean community at the very beginning. It's an associate member of Mercosur. But those are two countries that they were never favored the old model of integration. Now they are the main leading countries of this new initiative, this new bloc, which is called the Pacific Alliance, that could eventually spread through Central America with Costa Rica and Panama first, and maybe other countries. You will have completely kind of this new model of integration in the Pacific, and of course you have the Mercosur on the other side. What will be the interaction between the two, and what will be the interaction of these two with these other extra-regional, mega-regional agreements is maybe I'll leave this on the table for further discussion now and maybe probably into the future. Thank you.
Thanks. So in my 10 minutes, I am briefly going to focus on the TPP and what this might mean for Latin America. And I choose the TPP partly because it's really the most active trade negotiation, hopefully close to being finalised. WTO is going through a process of stocktaking at the moment. The transatlantic deal is slowly making progress. And I think it's also interesting because it's a trade negotiation which has some Latin American countries in, some Latin American countries out. And I think it's useful to demonstrate basically the premise, which is that the Latin America is going to experience this in very different ways. And the impacts of the TPP is going to be different depending on a range of factors. Just briefly, and I'll go into what those factors are shortly, but just briefly, for those not familiar with the TPP, I'm assuming most are 12 members, United States, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, a variety, Peru, Chile, countries in both South America, Central America, and also in Asia, approximately 40% of global GDP, a third of world trade, aim to turn this into a larger free trade agreement, FTAA, of the Asia-Pacific, is one of the goals. Other countries have indicated interest, South Korea, one of them, Taiwan, others. And so there's a set of members with momentum behind it, making progress on a whole range of WTO plus rules, so rules that are not in the WTO, also rules that go a lot deeper than the agreements in the WTO, sort of being held up as the gold standard trade agreement by the United States, where it will be setting the template rules for the trade and investment in the Asia-Pacific region sort of this century and beyond. In terms of the impact of this on Latin America, my sense is it's worth looking at three variables here. One clearly is which countries in Latin America are in the TPP. So in this respect, Chile, Mexico and Peru, all TPP members. Another important dimension here is the extent, I think, that countries in Latin America have FTAs with the United States. And the reason I say that is because, essentially, the United States is still the number one or two trading partner for most countries, if not all countries, in Latin America. I mean, often that's China or the United States, and it just depends on the country. And so just as an aside, in fact, I think an important bit of this is what does China do in terms of the TPP for Latin America? Because I think certainly it's important that the US obviously is the leading country in TPP, but certainly in terms of China's decision going forward, this will have a significant impact on Latin America as well. Again, depending on whether they're in the TPP or not. So if you look at countries in Latin America with FTAs with the United States, there's Colombia, Panama, Central America, Peru, Chile, others. And so this is also going to be another variable which I think will have an important impact on the impact of the TPP effectively on these countries, and I'll go into that in a little bit more detail. And I think another important dimension which we've already touched on briefly is whether that country is part of Mercosur or the Pacific Alliance. Now, Mercosur is a customs union, Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, Paraguay, Venezuela and Bolivia, all countries which are not part of the TPP. Interestingly, the Pacific Alliance, which is a new arrangement, which is Mexico, Colombia, Peru and Chile, with Panama and Costa Rica as potential near-term candidates. And just a bit of background on the Pacific Alliance, because it's a newer arrangement with less visibility, I think. Approximately 200 million people, 30-35% of Latin American GDP, 55% of exports, essentially built up of existing FTAs between the Pacific Alliance countries. So the focus of the Pacific Alliance, interestingly, has been, in addition to the trade part, has been in areas where you don't traditionally see a lot of integration, at least early on, so on capital markets, stock exchanges, trying to eliminate visas in particular categories, sharing embassies in some respects overseas. So it is an alliance with definitely a trade and economic focus, but certainly ambitions to go significantly broader than that. Within the Pacific Alliance, obviously, we have an interesting combination where Mexico, Chile and Peru are all TPP members, and all the alliance members have got FTAs with the United States. So this leads me, I think, to simplify all this and to make my point, I'm going to focus on two countries in Latin America, Brazil and Colombia. And I do this because they're both countries which are not in the TPP. One of them has an FTA with the United States, Colombia. One of them does not, Brazil. And one is a member of the Pacific Alliance, Colombia, and one is a member of Mercosur, Brazil. When I think through what the potential impacts then of the TPP are going to be, firstly, I divide it essentially in terms of market access and rules. On the market access side, the United States is Brazil's second largest trading partner, but I think if once you add in a couple of other TPP members, specifically Japan and Mexico, certainly that group is the largest trading partner for Brazil. Number two then would be China. Now, for Colombia, the United States is by far away the largest trading partner, approximately 35-40% of exports. So the impact now, but the impacts are going to be somewhat different. Because Colombia has an FTA with the United States, what Colombia is really going to be concerned about here, at least from a market access point of view, is erosion of its preferences under the FTA. Now, it's not clear. I mean, I think we could assume that the United States, on a market access side, is going to grant at least as preferential market access to TPP members as it does to Colombia. So Colombia can assume it will be, if not on possibly on a level playing field, just simply in terms of market access with TPP members, possibly at the margins slightly worse off in some areas if the United States goes further in the TPP context. For Brazil, of course, though, no FTA, not in the TPP, so they're going to face significant preference discrimination as being not part of the TPP. So in this sense, the TPP is going to be more negative, more harmful from a market access perspective on Brazil than it would be on Colombia. I just want to mention supply chains briefly because it's. I think what the TPP will do briefly here is it will reinforce, I think, the regional North American supply chain, NAFTA essentially, but possibly present some opportunities for extending this further into other TPP countries in Latin America, remembering that supply chains tend to be regionally focused. And I think here, What's interesting is that Colombia, as part of the Pacific Alliance, possibly will still be able to be involved in the development of these supply chains through the type of trade integration that's going to happen amongst those members and those members' participation in the TPP, whereas I think that Brazil, being part of Mercosur, which has got no links into the TPP, essentially, is going to be left out of the development of those supply chains, you know, to the extent that they are going to be driven by the TPP. On the rules bit, certainly, as I mentioned, I think that TPP is going to be a new standard for a whole range of rules in the Asia-Pacific region. And Brazil and Colombia, neither of them have a voice at the table in terms of shaping these new rules. But again, here, I think Colombia's FTA with the United States is important because, in many respects, Colombia is very familiar with the type of high standard rules that the United States requires in FTAs. A lot of the rules in the Colombia-US FTA will, in fact, be in the TPP. The TPP will certainly go further, but in many respects, Colombia has already been part of a negotiating process with rules which are going to be similar in a lot of respects to what's already in the TPP. That's obviously not going to be the case for Brazil. So just briefly in conclusion, I think that the impact of the TPP, the example I use, is going to vary across Latin America. And I think one of the key things to think about is whether or not the countries are in the TPP. Obviously, I think whether they've got an FTA with the United States matters here significantly, and also whether or not they're part of Mercosur Pacific Alliance, two trade groupings which are looking increasingly in different directions, is also going to be a key determinator. Thanks.
Thank you, Josh. Turning now to Jeff Shives from the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to join this distinguished panel. Tony started talking about 20 years ago when he gave very apt references to the situation then versus now. I'm going to go him even further and start 40 years ago, because 40 years ago I left this building and went to the Treasury to be a government official and U.S. trade negotiator. And I spent much of my first few years spending time in Mexico and Brazil, trying to get them to open their markets and expand and participate actively in the global trading system, with limited success, that much of which was rolled back at the start of the debt crisis in the early 1980s. It didn't matter that much in those days, because there was much less international competition. There is much more competition today, so it matters whether you are globally engaged or not. And that's where I want to start, building on the comments that we've heard so far. When I think back at Brazilian trade, when I look at Brazilian trade policy, for example, today, it reminds me far too much of Brazilian trade policy in 1978, and that's a problem for the hemisphere. I'm not going to give you a 40-year retrospective of my work on Latin America. That would bore you to tears. The last decade, though, one could put a label on it that you often hear with Latin America. And with regard to trade policy, we've had a lost decade for trade negotiations for Latin America as a whole. To be sure, the Pacific coast countries, excluding Ecuador, have turned north and west and have engaged in bilateral and regional initiatives that we've talked about so far. The Mercosur countries, by contrast, have followed a flawed strategy of engagement driven by politics and ideology, putting priority on intra-Mercosur expansion with a political focus, an expansion and trying to unify a group of very different countries called the BRICS, where there is no unity and where there has been a lot of wasted effort. So we've seen the collapse of the ALCA or FTAA negotiations. We've seen extended drift in the Doha round of WTO negotiations. We've seen EU-Mercosur negotiations struggling and adrift, and unlikely to succeed. And we've seen U.S.-Mercosur relations strained with inauspicious prospects for future success. what this has meant is that the countries that have focused on global engagement have moved forward, but not with regard to their neighbors and the neighborhood. And those that have not focused on global engagement or have put more priority on ideological issues have fallen back. You look at U.S. Trade relations in the region. The U.S. trades more with Mexico than the rest of Latin America combined. U.S. exports to Mexico are five times greater than U.S. exports to Brazil. U.S. imports from Mexico are 10 times greater than U.S. imports from Brazil. Clearly, geography has something to do with it, but it doesn't account for a large part of that difference, deeper integration accounts for a substantial part of it. So what I wanted to focus on is countries that are engaged versus countries that are disengaged, and that's the dividing line in Latin America. And it's there's a bit of a geographic dividing line as well that runs north-south through the hemisphere. But it doesn't need to be there, but it seems to be there for political reasons more than economic ones. On the Pacific side, you have the Pacific Alliance that have been reducing barriers within their region, both with the U.S., has been said, and by deepening the integration among themselves. The countries have trade agreements, free trade agreements with each other. The trick is to harmonize those and deepen the integration that had been achieved over the past decade. They are also participating in plurilateral negotiations as a way station to a renewed focus on multilateral trade accord, what I would call a Doha Round Plus agenda. Many of them are participating in the Trade and International Services Agreement, probably the most important plurilateral. Some are also involved in the International Technology Agreement, the second phase of that agreement. Only Costa Rica is in the environmental goods negotiation, which is about to get started. But all of these are very, very important and show a commitment to engagement and deepening ties across the Pacific and with North America. Now, there are some membership restrictions that prevent that deeper integration. Some of the members of the Pacific Alliance cannot participate in the TPP because there's an informal agreement that TPP will only involve APEC members, and Colombia and Costa Rica are not members of APEC, though they've been interested in joining for a long time. I've recommended at the most recent APEC meetings that are now being chaired by China this year that there be a reconsideration of APEC membership so that Latin American countries that are interested and engaged already economically can participate in APEC as new members going forward. That would be Colombia, Costa Rica, and Panama. That makes a lot of sense, and it would balance the three ASEAN members that are also not members of APEC, where it doesn't make any sense for integration among the Southeast Asian countries. That's a problem. There's also a membership problem with regard to the Transatlantic Initiative, which causes a rift as well in the trade relations of North and South America. But the key thing is the countries are engaged and moving forward to deepen that engagement. And that contrasts significantly with the Mercosur countries, where you have a dysfunctional customs union. There's no other way to describe it. It is dysfunctional. And so the countries are not gaining by their integration even among themselves. And they are not involved in any of the plurilaterals. None of those countries are. And they have been split regarding WTO objectives. And indeed, several of those countries are among the major foot draggers in moving the multilateral trading system forward. Brazil has been partly obstructionist, partly progressive in terms of the WTO over the last decade. Hopefully, with the Brazilian now as the leader of the WTO, it will take a more constructive view. And indeed, that seemed to be the case at the Bali WTO ministerial in December, where the Brazilian delegation was quite helpful and led their former leader to a successful conclusion of the first WTO agreement in 15 years. So that's leads one to the final question, in less than 2 minutes, I will finish it. And that is how what's going to happen going forward? I think there's a clear signal that the Pacific Alliance countries will become more globally integrated, will continue that pursuit because they're small countries and they don't really have an alternative. They have to engage, and they know it, and they have good people to move them in that direction. Whether Latin America becomes more integrated will depend importantly on Brazil and its Mercosur partners. Will they remain shackled to an ideology that focuses on political matters in the region instead of economic integration, or that will they become unleashed and become more active and constructive members of the multilateral system? If they do that, then there is a great opening for increased ties with Europe, with the United States, and for harvesting the gains from new agreements in the multilateral trading system. And I'm hoping that with constructive work with the United States and others that we'll see a turnaround in the Mercosur so that we can see more global engagement and regional integration in Latin America as well. Thank you.
Well, thank you all for this very illuminating discussion that really covered the waterfront of global trade negotiations and Latin America's place within them. I think we'll start with posing a couple questions to the panel to motivate some initial discussion. And after about 10 or 15 minutes of discussion, we'll open it up to the floor and take some questions from the audience. It strikes me that in listening to this discussion, I mean, we've been, I think, correctly focused on the countries that are most active in these mega trade negotiations and in the multilateral trade negotiations, a lot of focus on the Pacific Alliance countries, and a lot of doubts about the Mercosur countries. But still, if we look back at the past decade and the evolution of the region's economies, obviously both Brazil and China have been major players. And they have to be looking forward at the scenario that you've posed for us with great concern. And I wonder if I could probe a little more deeply and ask any or all of you to think about how Brazil should look at a scenario where it's basically left out of both of the major international mega trade negotiations. What should its reaction be? There's been some discussion of deep renewing talks in the European Union with all the problems that has, of course. And then again, China, the major new economic trading power in the region, how does it react to the scenario that you've proposed? And maybe we could just go in the same order.
Yep. Let me just maybe talk a little bit Brazil. And I think I agree with what has been said so far. Maybe the only thing I will add is that if there is an opportunity, we had an opportunity at some point in the last maybe 20 or 40 years in which these changes could occur, could be now, precisely because of this, what I mentioned before and what Jeff was saying. The Pacific Alliance creates a completely different counterbalance to Brazil. It's a completely different geopolitics now. We never had Brazil and Mercosur facing a group of countries in which you have Mexico, in which you have Chile, in which you have all these. So it's the first time in which you have two blocks in the region that in many, many respects will, I would say, weigh the same, but in a way could in a way, counterbalance to each other. And we didn't have this before. Mexico has been always isolated from the rest of the region, from Brazil. This is one of the missing links between these two countries. There's no free trade agreement. It has been tried many times, but they never had it. So if there's a time in which you could see that this counterbalancing of weights could move the action of Brazil could be now. That's one. I think what's one element. And I think here the game will be also played. The U.S. will have a big say. I mean, I look at the Pacific Alliance, and I see the P and the A. If the P will be basically pushed by the United States, get the Pacific side of the Pacific Alliance into the TPP, into the Asia side, and this is the lead of the United States will be critical for that particular. The A, the Alliance, which is a much more political kind of direction, will maybe also has to be played by Brazil. On the other side, Chile will probably also politically play with a different government now, a different mode of relation with Mercosur. So if we had the moment in the last 15, 20 years in which things could move, could be now. And just one, this is maybe an optimistic view of the situation, is that these integration initiatives, by definition, all of them are political. Of course, they are economic. Gains to be made. There's economic rationale behind them. But, integration is politics everywhere, starting with Europe. And sometimes politics dominate economics. Pacific Alliance could maybe till the way that Mercosur has gone into the political mode of integration to a more like an economic mode of integration. There's a chance for that happening. I know that it's a little bit an optimistic view, but I see that there's a chance for this happening.
Okay. Let me just briefly respond to a bit of the China element of the question, and particularly its interaction with Brazil, I guess. Speaking in sort of generally, if you look at trade between China and Brazil, you've got Brazil, which has been selling a lot of commodities, agricultural products, and China in return, which has been selling a lot of manufactured goods. And you might sort of at one level suggest that there's a complementarity in the trade, which is going to be beneficial to both countries, but in fact it's been really quite a source of uncertainty and friction in many respects. And part of this stems from part of the sort of the ideology and the politics of the way that both countries, in fact, have been thinking and approaching trade and economic policy. For Brazil, in part, it's been somewhat of the status lean and the focus on developing particular industries and manufacturing sectors, which has meant that these sectors have felt particularly under competitive pressure from areas of imports from China. I think on the Brazilian side as well, I think this is resonates a little bit more broadly in Latin America. There's been some hesitation about what the booming commodities prices has meant for the country and for the region. I think there's some reflection on previous commodity cycles which have left Latin America, poorer in some respects and certainly created certain levels of volatility. So the extent that Latin America's wanted to get on board wholeheartedly the commodity cycle, I think, has also been questioned. And on the Chinese side, China's had its own economic model, which, certainly since accession to the WTO has also seen increasing government ownership of the economy, roles of state-owned enterprises, and the currency issue in particular has been really a source of friction with Brazil. Brazil, in fact, has been one of the main leaders in the WTO context in terms of raising the currency issue vis-a-vis trade, and in many respects that's been driven by the competitive pressures it's felt from China. So in a sense, even though there might be some genuine complementarities in terms of the trading relationship, the different policies that Brazil and China have been pursuing, I think, has meant that the relationship has been a lot more complicated and complex than you might expect. So in a sense, their capacity, I think, to pursue deeper integration between themselves, which might be actually one dimension that you would think would be an offspring from both of them not participating in some of these large trade agreements, I think is very much coloured and not made possible by these types of models going forward. So the question is whether the reform objectives in China at the moment bear fruit and actually are implemented, and I think there's a question mark of what happens in Brazil going forward after the elections.
Very briefly and starkly, Brazil's policy is too much like 1978, and the way it can revise it and is to engage more actively in the plurilaterals. particularly the services agreement and the information technology agreement. That's where there are significant restrictions in the Brazilian economy that are impeding productivity growth. Brazil has to get its act together at home. If it improves its productivity, and it will increase its growth, it opens up a lot of new opportunities for international engagement. If it doesn't get its act together at home, then it's going to continue to be swayed by the protectionist arguments. Now, second point, China. China's already well positioned, so it's not a problem for China in the region. And the problem is much more than the bilateral trade, which we've been talking about. The real challenge for Latin America is Chinese competition in third country export markets. That's particularly important for Brazil. Not only is China a problem for Brazil with regard to Brazilian imports, it's a much bigger problem and a growing problem for Brazilian exporters to the United States and the European Union and other countries. So that's something that should be of concern to Brazil. For the Chinese, they're focusing on domestic rebalancing and on deepening their ties in the Asia-Pacific region. They're doing their homework. The question whether they will achieve the domestic economic reforms and how fast they'll move on that is an open question. But they realize they have to do that, and they're upping their game. So Latin America has to do even better.
Thank you. Let me pose one more question before turning to the audience. And this is one where I reflect back on the panel, and we heard about 40 years ago, we heard about 20 years ago, we heard about today. It strikes me we skipped over about a decade in the middle there, where I think there really was
It was a lost decade.
Yes, a decade of where it might be characterized as lost, but where there was an effort for South, at least in South America, regional integration, where there was originally a vision that Mercosul would expand to include the South Americas as a whole, where Venezuela proposed ALBA with all its peculiar characteristics, also as sort of a regional integration mold or framework within the region. Now we see a region which has been characterized as divided between the Pacific Alliance and Mercosul. Do you see those divisions as more or less permanent? Is that South American regional integration vision been permanently pushed aside? Is there something organic and inherent in that division that we see going forward? And anybody in the panel can respond to that as you like.
Just very briefly, I think you answered yourself the question. I think this is extremely, this is a dynamic, this is a very organic kind of type of integration what we have today, and it's very difficult to predict what's going to happen, the actual structure 10 years from now, 15 years from now. This is what we learned in these past few years. Here the question is how you are prepared to actually articulate, be flexible, be pragmatic in this type of. And this is one of the difference between the two projects that we are now just discussing. You know, the alliance, one of the things has shown is this great flexibility, great pragmatism, looking for the easy gains, short. This is something that we haven't seen in the region before. In the way that they are operating. Jeff was mentioning the case of Mercosur in terms of the customs union. This is one of the big problems of the region, you know, to have chosen this very difficult way of integrating through a customs union. This is one of the most complicated ways of doing integration. They copied from Europe. Nobody else has copied this. If you talk to the Europeans, they just forget about this part, but this was one of the most complicated stages of integration to set up the customs unions. The advantage is that if you do it well, like the Europeans, it creates a lot of functionality, a lot of institutionality to move beyond trade issues, you know, in terms of cooperation, energy, and other things. But if you don't do it well, you just, just miss the two boats.
Does anybody else want to jump in?
Look, I don't have any particular insights. I mean, I think probably just picking up on a couple of the comments, I think possibly a dynamic which we may or may not see playing out is the impact, is a competitive impact over time. I mean, in a sense, is the competitive liberalisation which, you know, Jeff, you and your colleagues have been talking about. I mean, to the extent that, I mean, I think the real division in Latin America, I mean, to some extent it's Pacific Alliance, Mercosur, but I mean, it's really sort of TPP members and those who have integrated with the US versus the Mercosur side. And, you know, I think as, you know, the TPP finishes and, you know, China in particular, which is a very important trading partner for Brazil and a lot of Mercosur countries, you know, furthers its reform efforts, assuming their success there, and they integrate into the Asia-Pacific more deeply, and the TPP becomes a vehicle for pulling those countries in South America into that orbit as well. I think these countries are going to be increasingly left out, and the question, I think, is going to be whether the competitive outcomes from that are sufficiently significant enough to actually drive some reform.
I'll just add just a quick note. I was very pleased that Tony mentioned the difference between going for a free trade agreement and or a customs union in the Mercosur, and that decision was taken in the early 1990s. I recommended to the Mercosur countries, while they were in the course of making that decision, that they go for a free trade area. It gave more flexibility, but they decided on a customs union as a way of force-feeding integration. Even then, it was possible that that could be a constructive step and lead to broader hemispheric integration. And you had the FTAA making progress. You had the Mercosur deepening its integration for the first half decade. But it fell apart. And as the Mercosur expanded, it lost its economic integration focus and was favoring political objectives of which came at a high economic cost. That is not in concrete. It can change if there is enough of an incentive. It's coming at a very high cost to the peoples of Venezuela, Bolivia, Ecuador, and lost opportunities for the countries of Mercosur. But you could see a revival of a type of hemispheric initiative. There's no reason why this couldn't be not put together the same way it was 10 or 15 years ago, but drawing on the experience of the Pacific Alliance, drawing on the ties of the Mercosur countries that could be reestablished or deepened with Europe and the United States, you could find a way of putting those pieces back together. So I'm not totally pessimistic, but I think the politics is really very depressing, and at least in the short term.
Well, on that note, I'd like to open the floor up to questions from our brave audience that came out in spite of the snowy weather today. We greatly appreciate that. Let me start with Peter, and then I'll go back and forth, front row and then back row, and I'll keep a list.
He's going to start with 50 years ago.
No. Let me just say that I think that you're drawing too stark a difference between the Pacific Alliance countries and Brazil. True, Brazil doesn't have a free trade agreement. It's part of a dysfunctional alliance. But if you look at trade figures between 2000 and 2012 between Brazil and the United States, trade has almost doubled. In other words, Brazil has a very active external. Secondly is Brazil was exporting commodities to China and to Asia. Well, so was Chile. And Chile's now sort of suffering a bit on the copper. Peru was exporting commodities as well. And so, you know, I'm not sure when you get down into the grass that you're going to see that big a difference in their actual sort of what they have actually done and accomplished. And I think things are going to become even more complex as we see that, you know, there's four presidents signed the Pacific Alliance in 2010. Three of them have now left office. And in each case, their successor is probably less enthusiastic about the Pacific Alliance than the original signers, and particularly the last president, Michelle Bachelet, has made clear, I mean, speech after speech and interviews that their major foreign policy objective is now to repair a relationship with Brazil and to, in fact, downplay the Pacific Alliance. And the Chileans are now talking about melding the Pacific Alliance, which may be right, with the Mercosur, but I think both sides will have to make enormous compromises to get there. And I'm really not sure Mexico has much of an interest, except the political interest in the Pacific Alliance. That is, that they want an entry point back into South America. And very little to do with the economics.
Thank you, Peter. If you want a quick reaction, or should we take a few questions first? You want to go ahead?
We'll take
two more questions over here in the front row and then one in the back row, and then we'll come back to the panel.
I just wanted to know, how does the need for Brazil to open up affect the upcoming presidential election there?
Okay. Thank you. And I think the gentleman in the tan jacket, white sweater in the back, in the middle. And if somebody has a question over on this side, please raise your... Okay,
yes, I had a question about Chile following up on that comment. Do you see the change in government there as posing any threat to TPP? And do you think this is more quibbling around the edges and that Chile is actually likely to maintain its long-term orientation towards openness, or is there a more fundamental shift at play? Thank you.
Thanks. A good set of questions to get it started with. And if any of you would like to jump in?
Yeah, maybe just let me just quickly comment on maybe it's on the first question and the last quickly. I don't think we disagree on the geopolitics of Brazil and I mean the Pacific Alliance and Mercosur. The only thing I would say is that I think what you mentioned is that there's some economic rationale for to understand the incentives of Mercosur, linking up with the United States and with the rest of the... And this, I think, was my point. I think there's a chance now in which the blocks have become, if you want to call it blocks, have become, the same weight. So there's a really chance now so that this conversation gets... the economics, I think, will incentivize that. I don't think they will play against that. And the politics could be also. I mean, what's happening in Chile, I think they will play the politics on that way. And this brings me to the last question. I don't think that Chile will change their direction. This is very, very established, I think. There's going to be some, political gestures, and I think it's going to be good that there's some conversation, some dialogue with the partners in Mercosur. I don't think it's bad, but I don't think it's going to change the direction of trade policy in Chile. And one of the reasons, I think, will be that a lot of the focus of the current Chilean government will be on the domestic issues. So, trade policy will be probably on a second rank. Will not make the headlines when difficulties come in the last phases of the TPP negotiations. So I think will help probably to conduct business the same way they have done it so far.
I'll just say briefly, I don't think there's much disagreement here. I think quickly on the Brazil-US bit, absolutely there's been significant growth in trade, certainly when you look back over the 2000s. I think the issue for Brazil is going to be, once agreements like the TPP come into effect, what's going to be in the impact around a range of commodity and agricultural exports to countries like the United States, particularly when they don't have an FTA with them. I agree with the Chile comment. I think in a way... Chile's policy settings, I think, are fairly established. And I think, interestingly, given their FTA with the United States, but also they've got very ambitious FTAs with Australia, for instance, and other countries, which I think provide a certain lock-in in terms of what their sort of economic structure is going to be, which possibly, I think, has created a bit of political space to make these overtures to Brazil without damaging or kind of putting into question these kind of key economic settings.
Very briefly, I've learned a lot from Peter over the years about Brazil. I'm going to try to reciprocate. U.S.-Brazil trade has increased, but it hasn't increased very much. compared to what it should be doing. U.S.-Brazil trade has grossly underperformed for a long time. And it's not just the geography. There's a lot of restrictions in the way. So there's a great opportunity if we actually work together to have a very substantial expansion of trade. Second point. I think TPP is driving the integration of the Pacific Alliance countries because those countries, or several of the countries, are engaged in TPP, and TPP obligations will force changes in policy which will reinforce the integration among the Pacific Alliance countries. The challenge there is that some of the countries are not in the TPP and are going to have to sort of move on TPP obligations without getting the benefits, and which is why I suggested expanding membership. I'm not an expert on Brazilian elections. Peter knows much more than I on that. But I don't believe these issues will have a great impact on the election. I think it's going to, the election will have a great impact on these issues going forward, not the other way around. And I agree with Tony on Chile. Chile is really invested in global integration and deepening its ties, trade and investment across the Pacific. And while there will be some tweaking of particular positions in the TPP and elsewhere, particularly on intellectual property issues in the endgame negotiations of the TPP, I don't think there will be any significant change in Chilean policy.
Just take moderator's privilege to jump in and just comment here that I agree that on the one hand, Brazil is postponing a number of decisions because of the elections coming up, but I don't think it's really postponing any decisions about its fundamental decisions about its trade orientation. They're still committed to Mercosur, and what they really need to figure out is how they move Mercosur forward into some sort of relationship with the European Union over the objections of Argentina, largely, is at least the Brazilian interpretation of what's going on. And they'll probably have to wait until after the elections to really make that move. But it's still fundamentally a commitment to their present institutional arrangements. And on the Chile question related to the Pacific Alliance, I think the sense I got from the President Bachelet's team is really what they object to is the ideological overtones that the Pacific Alliance had acquired rather than the economic dimension. It was this sense that the Pacific Alliance were the good guys and, you know, ALBA or Mercosur were the bad guys in some way, that kind of vision that some of the more conservative former presidents now that have left office might have occasionally raised. And I think people want to, as they say in Chile, bajar el tono, you know, just lower the ideological tone of the debate and focus it much more on the economic dimensions, what's going on. But turning now, I think there was a question over here. And we'll take another round of questions.
Thank you. Hi, thank you very much for the presentation. Dave Nelson with GE. One of the positive developments on both sides of the Andes over the last decade has been the commitment to macroeconomic stability, by and large, or at large. This is macroeconomic stability, fiscal responsibility, with social inclusion, with remarkable reduction in poverty, tremendous achievement. Some would argue it was driven largely by a commodity boom. That seems to have played out. So the question is, going forward, looking at the link between trade policy and macroeconomic stability, are the countries that are committed to the free side, the free trade angle, are the Pacific Alliance countries more likely to be able to survive this kind of changing trade environment? Are we going to see a divergence on both sides, not only in trade policy, but on the macroeconomic stability as well?
Thank you. I think let's go in the back and then to this in front.
Hi. Thanks. Doug Palmer with Politico. Jeff, you talked about expanding the membership of TPP. I guess to bring in the Pacific Alliance members, that's what I thought perhaps you were suggesting.
APEC.
Expanding APEC.
Membership.
Right. Which would then make those Pacific Alliance members eligible for TPP.
Right.
PP. Okay. Well, I guess I just had a question sort of on the opposite side. I mean, is there any, assuming that didn't happen, I mean, is there any reason for the U.S. to seek to become a member of the Pacific Alliance? I mean, do you know if there's any discussion in that regard? And then secondly, I had a conversation with some folks at the U.S. Chamber, and they said that they were working with the main Brazilian embassy, main Brazilian industry group down there, and they were going to commission a study on a bilateral free trade agreement. They're calling it a BEPA, I guess, an economic partnership agreement. Anyway, just for anybody, does that seem realistic at this point?
Okay. And I think we have one more question here in front.
Hi, Tom Long with American University. Part of the reason that NAFTA was so successful was precisely because of the level of value chain integration that occurred. That doesn't seem to have been as salient or as prominent in some of the other FTAs between the United States and Latin American countries. Correct me if I'm wrong on that. Is that really just to do with geography? And if so, why should we expect more value chain integration in the TTP and the other agreements that we're seeing now, as it pertains to Latin America in particular? Thank you.
Okay, great, thank you. All right, I think we have another excellent set of questions. Jeff, do you want to let me, we'll go in reverse order this time and start with you? Or?
Okay. I won't address everything. Ambassador Nelson knows Latin America very well. But he's asking a question for the Inter-American Development Bank, so I'll punt on that one, even though I could give an answer. Tom's question is a very good one. He's done a lot of excellent work with the late Bob Pastor in the need of deepening integration. So the lessons of North America also apply to the lessons of South America. And there I'd say one of the things that Bob Pastor talked about a lot was improving infrastructure investment. And that would be a crucial step in opening up new opportunities for Latin American economic integration, the physical infrastructure. Some of it has occurred, linking electricity grids, gas pipelines, and the like. Much more could be done, and that would have a very strong impact. Finally, Doug Palmer's questions on should U.S. join the Pacific Alliance. Well, the first step is Ambassador Froman has noted the U.S. interest in the Pacific Alliance and the support for the Pacific Alliance. That's a little different than saying we want in and we want to run the show. And indeed, if he had taken that second step, you know, he may have scared a lot of people off, and perhaps rightly. So I think U.S. encouragement for progress on integration among the countries in the Pacific Alliance, U.S. support for that group is very important and probably the way we should go right now. In terms of the chamber, I think one of the things they were talking about was interest in deepening U.S.-Brazil economic ties and seeing how maybe not a traditional free trade agreement, but how where there are challenges and where there are opportunities for the U.S. and Brazil to work more closely together to achieve the type of potential expansion of trade and investment that I was talking about before in answering to Peter. That's very important, and indeed, my comments today may have seemed very negative on Brazil, but it's only because I see such great potential upside that is not being taken advantage of. And so for that reason, my colleagues and I at the Peterson Institute are probably going to do that study.
Look, just briefly on the commodity cycle, macroeconomic stability, obviously, except for Argentina. But, you know, it's an issue, I think, that plays out for a range of countries in Latin America, because you've had Brazil, but you've also had Chile, and you've had Peru, who've had, you know, benefited significantly from the commodity cycle. And I think, you know, to the extent that, I mean, I'm not even too sure I completely, the premise of the unwinding of the cycle, I think, is still in question. I mean, you know, where it's, the highs have come off, but I think potentially there's still a long way to run. I mean, considering the urbanisation that still has to take place in China, and increasingly also in India down the track. But that said, you know, in a way, the macroeconomic stability piece, I think, going forward is going to be really the key driver of the extent that they do manage the transition. I mean, if you where and how the boom period has been spent and used. I mean, to the extent that the policies have relied on, you know, the type of capital inflow which has then been used for inefficient government spending or programs, or hasn't been used to actually address key costs like infrastructure bottlenecks, the Brazil costs that people talk about, means that going forward, you know, managing the cycle coming off is going to be significantly harder, both economically and I think also will have its own political ramifications, whereas economies, I think, on such as if you take Chile, for example, which have been, you know, more open on a trade front, certainly I think are going to be better placed going forward to maintaining that and to benefiting still from the next opportunities. I think I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, maybe I'll add something. I don't have much to add on the macro question. I think the reversal of the trade tide that we had definitely will pose a challenge for the macroeconomic stability on some. And I think here the answer is to it becomes even more urgent to push to forward with these trade deals. That's, I think, the only thing that I would add to Joshua. But on the productive integration or the kind of the value chain integration, which is a very interesting question, because as you know, the Pacific Alliance is one of the goals that the Pacific Alliance has. It's really a long-term goal. Today's intra-regional trade in the Pacific Alliance is extremely small. It's only 4 or 5%. It's extremely very little trade going on between these two others. So from here to actually have, you know, really the type of productive integration that you have between the United States and Mexico is far from the road. But the focus is what Jeff just said. Here the focus is on looking at where are really the bottlenecks for these things happening. What are the conditions that you have to have for that type of platforms and the infrastructure and logistics? Huge. This is a huge bottleneck in most of the region. And the regulatory issues. When we talk about regulatory issues here, we talk about the issues that will allow firms to coordinate better their operations. And this means harmonizations of standards, means contractual issues about, you know, firms operating in different parts of the country. So this is a completely different agenda of what we are used to in terms of trade negotiations. And the Alliance has put this in terms of the next steps of negotiations. And I think it's in the right direction in a sense.
Thank you. No, I think the infrastructure question that remains an open one, whether the Pacific Alliance will be able to pull this off, because if we think back to the roots of organizations like UNASUR, were in the infrastructure integration for South America project that former President Fernando Henrique Cardoso had promoted, and which 12 years later really hasn't borne fruit. So still very much on the agenda of the region, even after 15 years. I think we have time for maybe one or two more questions. I think there's one here in the back.
Oh, good afternoon. Rosine Plank-Rumbach from the OAS, and a veteran of the FTAA negotiations and still traumatized by that. I was wondering whether Jeff and Tony in particular could give us an example of the type of, shall we say, offensive economic incentive for Brazil that would overcome its Mercosur fixation or domestic protectionist interests that might be of interest to entice it. What would be of interest specifically in the U.S. market other than continuing to watch a certain preference, improve preferences by perhaps other competitors when Brazil only benefits from GSP? And a second part would be, would that kind of calculus be better in the WTO negotiation setting as opposed to a more primarily a hemispheric focus.
Thank you. And I think perhaps the last question over here, and then we'll go back to the panel for some concluding remarks.
Thank you very much for the excellent presentation. My name is Mungra, Ambassador of the Republic of Suriname. Here I am stuck with the question, what would be your advice for the many small island economy because of the small scale? Because they are now stuck in the middle. The hopes with regard to the positive outcome of the Doha round or WTO, obviously small economies benefit more from multilateral trade framework than bilateral. But given the fact that that seems to be a very long-term option, now, what would be your advice as to the repositioning of the smaller economy face-to-face these mega trade negotiation, the TPP and the TIPP? Thank you.
Thank you. I think the two excellent questions on which to end this panel. If any of you would like to jump in, I think.
Maybe just very, very briefly on Rosine's question. I'll go back to what Jeff said a while ago. More than just look at the specific offensive interests on specific sectors or specific products, this is about productivity in the case of Brazil. I mean, you really have to change your cost structure, your productivity. And for that, you need to change your service sectors. And so it's not about, you know, what you gain in terms of your market access in economies like the United States, but what will, what benefits will you will gain in terms of productivity gains. I think this is the kind of the bottom line for Brazil. And very small answer to something that we didn't talk about here, which is the small economies, and in particular the Caribbean. Here, more than for me, the Caribbean, the challenge is more than thinking about the TPP or the TTIP. It's about thinking about the region. This is a region has not been yet connected to our own region, to South America, and I think this is probably the first homework that a group of countries like the Caribbean have to do. You know, beyond thinking about the European or the U.S., reconnect with your own region, with Brazil and with the big economies of South America. That's, I think, is one of the missing links that we have in the region.
Just briefly, on the ambassador's question. I mean, I think despite the, I think the multilateral round, you know, despite difficulties with it, you know, should clearly, still be a focus. But I think the fact is that it's always important to keep in mind. I think that when one thinks about trade liberalisation, you know, ultimately the benefits are to the country liberalising, and in many respects, you know, trade liberalisation is about a driver of domestic economic reform. So I think, you know, the key here, and I think picking up on this point about regionalism, is what needs to be done domestically to drive competitiveness, where the opportunities, and that's both, I think, a strategic assessment about, you know, what are the country's opportunities, what needs to be done, what can be done regionally and built out there, and I think that in itself, I think, can help then inform a larger question about how you then integrate globally, whether it is through particular trade negotiation here or there, what those pathways are. But getting it right domestically, I think, is a key starting point.
Well, I agree with everything that's just been said by both Tony and Josh. Let me just reinforce that on both the questions. For Rosine, what Brazil can do in that context, don't think about it in the bilateral mercantilist merchandise trade focus, but Brazilian participation in the plurilaterals will encourage the type of domestic reforms that are needed. And that will, there the United States can work with Brazil, even though it's not a bilateral context. So that's one thing. With regard to the small economies, this takes me back to a paper that Barbara Kochwar and I wrote during the FTAA days about small and vulnerable economies. And as you said, you're still vulnerable. So what Tony said is absolutely right, integrating in the region. But it also means continuing what these countries restarted in Bali, and that is constructive engagement in the multilateral negotiations. For too long in the Doha round, small economies were scared of the competition and scared of additional adjustment from reform, and therefore was part of the foot-dragging element in the among WTO membership. In Bali, we saw a much bigger, a very important change in moving towards measured but constructive reform that allowed the trade facilitation agreement to be passed, despite the objections of a few major foot draggers. And I think continuing that way and moving towards a revival of broader multilateral negotiations will also help. That has a slightly longer time horizon than trying to move immediately on deepening integration in the neighborhood. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to thank all three of our panelists, Tony, Josh, Jeff, for an extremely interesting and lively panel, and to thank our audience for joining us today. I'd also like to thank my colleague, Ernesto Talvi, at Global Expo for helping to organize, I think, the second of the two joint events that the Latin America initiatives at Brookings have had, and to our staff members who, of course, did all the hard work in putting this together. So thank you all.